did I dream about that?
Okay, yes, we're going to tape, we're going to record, and then send it to Richard Hartsman. Someone doing that if you can?
Okay, good. Yes.
Hi, Richard.
So Kohelis is like what the Gemara means about a bad dream. You got to think about things some once in a while. Life isn't all a party, and there are going to be inevitable problems. How are you going to deal with those problems? Are you ready for them? Kohelis is like insurance.
You know, life is filled with ups and downs. And you, all right, let's just be ready to deal with them. Okay? So listen to what Ibn Ezra does with the first pasuk. This is incredible. You need a grammarian to do this. Right? So he says, Havel Havolim Amar Koheles. Havel Havolim Hakol Hevel. Right? A lot of things we do seven times is because of this pasuk. Right? You see, you keep counting this as two, four, five, six, seven. Okay. We on the way to bury someone, you ever see this? You stop seven times. It's a day that you say tachanun. The day you don't say tachanun, but shchoyah, shchol amor, you don't do that. If you stop seven times, you recite the 91st Psalm seven times. Right? Well, you shouldn't have funerals to go to, but... Right? Even the bride circling her husband seven times under the chuppah, the Mepharshim say is from this pasuk. Why seven? Why not three? Why not 12? Right? So what does that have to do with heaven? So this is what Ibn Ezra says. It's amazing. The word isn't hevel havolim, it's Havel Havolim. Right? This too, I'm going to tell you because I'm teaching here 41 years ago. People tell me 20 years after they take Chamesh Megillos with me, this is what I remember. So I'll let you know what those things are over time.
Where is seven number?
What?
Where is seven number?
Because Havolim counts as two, it's plural.
That's
two,
five.
Four, five, six, seven. Havel Havolim is three. Havel Havolim is another three. And call Hevel, it's you. Ibn Ezra says that this word doesn't mean what your English translation. Everyone have an English translation here? Just read it. Not anybody have English? No one? What does it say?
It's a party. Futile.
Utter petulance. Futility of futilities, right? In other words, this is like Kodesh Kodoshim, Shir Hashirim. You get it? Havel Havol. No, that would be Hevel Havol. Address in layers. Havel, get this? Is it Tzivui, says Ibn Ezra. This is not a format like Kodesh Kodashim, Shir Hashirim, Pile Ployim. No. It's a tzivuy. Anybody here know enough grammar to figure out what he means to say?
It's a command.
It's a command. Hakol Hevel just means that most of the things out there are not worth sweating over. Right? You see what he's saying? There's so many things in the world that are nonsense. Havel them. That's how he's opening up. He says, I want you to do in life is concentrate on the things that matter. And so you have, especially Rashi. Rashi's very good at doing this in the Torah. When you take something that looks very negative and you make a positive out of it. Okay? Rashi does that throughout the Torah, Vayikra and Devarim. He says, this looks very bad, but let me explain to you what the Gemara says about this. And he tells you what we call the silver lining. You've heard of that, right? Okay. My father was a Holocaust survivor. He was a member of a survival group of Vilnian Jews from the Crimea, it was today the Ukraine. It was Ukraine today. So there were hundreds and hundreds of them. We used to meet together on occasion. And when I became a rabbi, they were very proud that one of their own, no, became a rabbi. So I used to speak to this group quite often, right? And Nebuch, most of them lost their, when they were, almost all went to Cheder, some were Hasidim, some were more pays, almost all lost their faith, what they went through. And I remember discussing this Ibn Ezra to them, and I cited, bless you, I cited a Rav who was taught here in NYU after the war. His name was Rav Shatzkis. And he had this habit also, he was also a survivor, and he would look for every silver lining in what happened to him personally, what happened to the war, what happened to, and what's written in the Tochacha. So he quoted one of the prophecies, V'achaltem es besar v'neichem, v'es besar v'noseichem tochim. You will eat the flesh of your sons and the flesh of your daughters you shall devour. He says, what's going to be positive about that? Right? My father escaped his ghetto when it was being liquidated. He was never caught, but he spent two Ukrainian winters in flight. Right? You get caught, they will rip you apart limb from limb until you tell them where you're hiding your treasure and where the people you're fighting with are hiding. Right. So, and he was 19 at the time. So he caught up with Peps and partisans. And I remember he used to go with me through the Torah. He said, I saw that. He said, but I never saw Jewish people eating their children. He said, I did not see that. So everything else in the Torah, but this prediction I did not see. There used to be a story in Tanakh about two women. You know what I'm talking about? Malach and Bet. One took the other one to court because they boiled their baby the day before, because it was the starvation. And then we were supposed to boil her baby today, and she's hiding her baby. We ate my baby yesterday, now I want to eat her baby. And it was a court case. Right? It's a kinah on Tisha B'Av. Right? But that my father said he never saw. He did see one time that one of the partisans we were fighting with informed the Germans of their hiding place, and they caught him and they ate him. Pardon me. They offered my father a piece, and he said, "How crazy he was." He said, "I cannot. I'm not eating a person." Right? There's a tremendous harashba on this topic about eating a person to save your life, but I'm not going to get into that now. So this is what Rav Shatzkis did, which is similar to what Ibn Ezra is doing here. He said that when we came to America with our children, a lot of them just fell out. Frumkeit very quickly. A lot of us fell out of Frumkeit. You know, we felt betrayed, and the children, especially with they came to the Golden of Medina, and this was happening not long before 1940, right? All right. So he said that it got so bad that you couldn't eat in your children's house. Right. So here is the Torah telling us. Listen to the words. V'achaltem es besar v'neichem. You can go to your children's house and eat a hamburger, and eat the frankfurters, you can eat their turkey, you can eat their meat. You get it? The chaltim is besar b'neichem. I can go into your freezer, take out a steak, and make a steak in your oven, and I can eat it because it's kosher here. Right? You see what he did? Okay. He took what is naturally an awful, horrific prophecy of being so hungry. Wouldn't you rather starve to death than eat your baby? Right? But you're going to do that because your mind is going to go haywire from the hunger. So you see what he's doing? Everybody else translates this futility of futilities along the Hebrew custom of writing words this way. Pile ploy means not just wonders, but wonder of wonders. The guy sings in Fiddler on the Roof, right? Not just Kodesh, but Kodesh Kodosh, not just a Shirim, as we'll see later. Alright? In this semester. This is not futility of futilities, which is worse than just plain futility. No. This is a call to look for what doesn't matter and treat it that way. I know when it says I called Hevel at the end, it sounds like, was there anything but Hevel? No, he just says it's 60% Hevel. Right? It's more than 50% Hevel. That's what it is. Okay? It's more than 50% Hevel. Okay, guys, yeah.
Two quick questions. One is the last one Hakol, is it Hakol Hevel or Hakol Hevel? In other words, is that also the same way?
No, no, because Hakol, it becomes Hevel only because when an E or an A turns to O at the end of the pasuk.
So that still means, it's still the noun, not the command.
Yeah, but he's saying, what he means is, as you are evaluating what to treat as Hevel, understand that it's mostly Hevel. I think there's a saying, right? Maybe hear it? Don't sweat the small stuff, and it's mostly small. Did you hear that? Mm. Mostly small, which means, you know, it's a saying in Chazal, Rubo Kechulo. You only have to cut 51% of the pipes of an animal to make it shed, to finish it, to be kosher. So Rubo Kechulo. We don't always say Rubo Kechulo, but we have to create, if it was a long dishes section, now I'd create, why don't we say six men make a minion? Right? There are sometimes where you need the full thing in order to have what you need. But in other cases, you just need a robe of the thing. All clear? We make decisions all the time based on like probabilities or like, you know, what's the likelihood of this thing being so. Right? Sometimes you want to, you know, sometimes you're prescribed a medication and it says, well, 30% of the time you lose your legs if you take this. You're not going to take it. All right? 70% of the time it's going to cure you. Yeah, you're not going to take that. All right? So, okay, everyone clear? So let this set the stage for how we're going to learn this book. Right? It's a workout. Right? And we will understand it in line with some other philosophical modes of that existed in the world. Not so much at the time of Koheles. I'm not going to really go into Confucius, but I will go into some things that Socrates and Aristotle discussed about human conditions and things that connect to this. Okay, so okay. What do we expect of God down here? Right? What got Cain upset? God, you're not fair. It looks to me like I'm not being treated fairly. Right. So what does fairness require? The whole governmental systems today that argue about this. Whether it's equality, whether it's equity, whether it's equal opportunity, whether it's equal outcome. There are all kinds of debates about this today in various governments. What Koheles tries to do is to predict human behavior. What prediction can we make about what works? What are incentives that work with people? Maybe some of you are familiar with a work called Freakonomics. Have you ever heard of that? Freakonomics, they try to predict human behavior. And it's fascinating because my daughter runs a play group in Israel, and the one case they said that they throw up their hands and they can't figure it, cannot influence human behavior, is to get Israeli parents to pick up their kids on time from playgrounds. There's nothing, no incentive, and the reason is because the only thing that will work is to say, if you don't come on time to pick up your child, I will kill him. If you did, if the person really felt you would kill the child if the person didn't come on time, they would always come on time. Trust me, my daughter misses appointments all the time because parents come consistently 10, 15, 20 minutes late to pick up their kids. So the parents know that playgroup leader is not going to go so far with my kid as to just leave him. I'm going to leave the kid in the house. No, in fact, I'm going to do worse. I'm going to leave him right outside the door, and you can pick up your 2-year-old. Right? Nothing gets them to go. I know they said it was in a cop. There was a terrorist attack. I couldn't get through. The bus is stopped. Yeah. Okay. Everybody has an excuse. And they just said and the book solves every problem. How to get people to pay for the bagels that they leave out, and how to get people to pay for the cakes that are just left and say, please pay a dollar for this, you know. But this one they couldn't figure out. Right? So we have Koheles tries to predict certain elements of human behavior and say, what's going to work best? How is your workout at the gym of life going to produce the best result. Right? So this book isn't so depressing anymore. Okay? In fact, Shira Shira is much more depressing than Coelus. Coelus is supposed to be like, you know, it's Man Simchaseinu on Sukkos, so just calm yourself down a little. Right? Perhaps the best story, if you've learned the fifth parrot in the Sechas Brachos, was someone's at a wedding, and he sees that the people are getting drunk. People are enjoying themselves too much. So what did he do? He took a 400 zuz kli, and he threw it against the wall in order to say, guys, calm down a little. This is not, you're not here to just get drunk, and it's a nice simcha for the couple, but let's calm down a little. Chill. And Tosfos on that Gemara, the Flamin Aleph and Aleph says, it's for this reason that we break a glass at weddings today. Nothing to do with the chuppah, originally. It's the earliest reference to breaking a glass at wedding. Right? Okay. All right, so what kind of system is this? Yeah, it's a system that says, be careful. Life is going to have its inevitable problems. How will you be in shape to deal with them? Or as the saying goes, calm seas never made for a skillful mariner. Get it? Okay. Okay. Now, we have certain expectations, and the Torah gives us expectations. It says you do A, and then B will happen. You say that every day in your davening, right? This is what's going to happen if you listen. And then it tells you, this is what's going to happen if you don't listen. Right? An important point to make, not only with Koheles, but also the Torah's idea of fairness. When I tell my three-year-old, well, youngest is already almost 30, but when I tell my three-year-old, I said, grandchild, don't cross the street when the light is red, because if you do, finish my sentence. Well, you just said two different things, very different things. You said a car will hit you. You said you could get hit by a car. How does the Torah talk? This one. Okay? You're more realistic. You can go out on the street and you look both ways and look, okay, no car is coming. The light's red. I'm going to cross. 99 times out of 100, the car is not going to hit you. I must confess, I'm guilty of it too. Right? There are poskim who say that if it says don't walk, you're violating the din of the malchus by walking. Some government agency put in a sign that says don't walk, and you shouldn't walk then. Right? I'll tell you, the poskim that write these tshuvas say that it's only in a place where if a police officer saw you walk at that time, he would give you a ticket. Some places like in LA or some places where it's like a big thoroughfare with, you know, you have to wait for the light to change. But in New York, no one gets them. But I'll tell you this, on 96th and Broadway, I have a balabas who recently got a jaywalking ticket. $50 ticket for crossing from the median to the other side. And while the guy was giving him a ticket, he said, don't you see 30, 40 people crossing with the red? He goes, yeah, but I caught you. Now that sounded like it's not fair. What are you picking on me? Somewhere in Yarmulke? Well, you know, he did. He got the ticket. Right? Anyway, so your parent tells you, if you cross the street when the light is red, you say, a car will hit you. All right? The kid is with his friends, and a friend starts. He says, come on, let's cross. He goes, no, I can't cross. My father said if you cross when it's red, car will hit you. He goes, come on, get out of here. What are you talking about? And he follows him. He sees, oh, wait a second. Car didn't hit me. Right? And he starts crossing when the light is red, and it keeps happening. So, you know what? Parents are a liar. How much should I trust anything else, that person? Now, that's good. That's taking a little too far. But then imagine this case. Imagine someone waiting on the corner, and I know someone in Borough Park, this happened to 20 years ago, corner 48th Street and 14th Avenue. They were waiting on the corner for the light to change, and a car jumped the curb and killed one of them while waiting for the light to change. Had they crossed earlier, that car would have hit nobody. Because they would have been across the street on the other side. This is life is a game of inches all over the place. I'll tell you another story. This is someone I recently visited in a hospital after he lost a leg. His leg was amputated. He's going out of his, he lives in a high-rise building downtown on 64th and near Lincoln Center. And there's a big, long hallway to get out of from the elevator to the front door. Usually there's a doorman opening the door, greeting people in the morning. And this time, there's no one at the door. Where was the doorman? He doesn't know. He gets to the door, he opens it himself, and he sees a woman about 25, 30 feet behind him. So he does the gentleman, when someone's right behind you, you hold the door for them, right? So he's holding the door, and she stops about 15 feet away to do this. Pulls something out of her heel. So he says, okay, I'm not going to keep holding the door for her. So he walked. Less than a minute later, an ambulance jumped the curb, pinned him to the ground, he lost his right. Think of what's in his mind. If the doorman was there, I wouldn't have held the door for her. If she didn't stop to look, what would she step on? A raisin? Kid threw a piece of gum on the floor and she stepped right on it, that little heel. Had to step on that thing. Because if I held the door for her, then I would have been 15 feet behind the ambulance when it jumped the curb. Following? I wouldn't have been there. I would have waited another few seconds. With me? Right? If the doorman was there, I would have been 20 feet ahead of the ambulance when it jumped the curb. All these things coming together and I lost the leg. Right? So this is what Kohelis is confronting, guys, because this is life. Okay? You don't know what you miss. You don't know what you made the train, you didn't make the train. Isn't there a movie about a guy who strikes out with 3-2, bases loaded, his team is down by 3 runs, and then he gets to see how his life would be different if he hit the home run, and they won by 1 run, right? He goes through his whole life over again, and he gets to be his age now. Where am I now? And he's like the head of a company, and he's married to a glorious woman, and of course the whole movie is about how he longs for his previous life. Right? He's not married to the woman he's married to. He's married to this, and he's this fabulously wealthy man because he had that home run. Right? Anybody recognize this movie?
I was going to say there's a famous lawsuit out of Japan where two babies were actually switched at birth. One came from an extremely wealthy family. The other one was abandoned as a child. And the person sued the hospital for saying, had you not switched me at birth, I actually would have could not probably be successful. Because he pointed the other guy's life and said, basically, this should have been my life.
Yeah. That's a crazy story. Well, there's supposedly in Chazal between Antoninus and Rebbe. They were originally switched and they had to be switched back over. You have something like this, yeah?
No, I just wanted to say that this story, I feel like it's more characteristic of what Eeyore is saying.
Which story?
This story of that you were just telling about, bad things happening to people, even when they're,
Okay, that's since you mentioned
when they're pretty good people. I feel like Kohelet, I guess, why are you using a story like this to characterize Kohelet as opposed to something, the futility of human pursuits?
That's what we're going to get into right now. But because Kohelis deals with this, he goes, I see that what is supposed to come to a tzaddik gets to a rasha. And I see that what's supposed to come to the rasha gets to the tzaddik. What bothered Avraham was that the tzaddik and the rasha should share the same fate. Even by Sodom. God, how can you kill the tzaddik and the rasha? I shall fake kolorot lo yasevish, but people will say you're not fair. I'm trying to get people to recognize you, to follow you, and who's going to follow you if the people who follow you or the people who don't share the same fate? So Kohelis is worse than that. Right? Then afterwards, Avraham changes direction.
if the God agreed, no, don't worry, I'm not gonna harm the tzaddikim. Don't worry, they're safe. So Nahum says, ooh, he's in a good mood. Let me try. Maybe if there are enough tzaddikim in that place, maybe they can influence the other's God and maybe save everybody, even the Rishonim. Then he argues 50 million down to 10. So we'll get to that later. There's a pasuk in Kohelet that fits very well with that. Yes, if you look at your front page here, did I give this out last time? Anybody still not get? Because I have a few more. Alright, so you see at the top, after we talk about canonization, which we did last class, the process by which Kohelet almost lost its canonicity, and then we brought it back, you have here, yeah, these are theodicy questions that go across the scope of Tanakh, right? I'm actually going to skip all the theodicy, right, and C and D. I'm just going to mention them right now, which is B, C, and D, because I want to go right into the topics. Right? B, C, and D we will see manifesting itself throughout the book. Okay. Theodicy is the, basically asking Cain's question. God, I was the one who came up with the idea of thanking you for my bounty. Why are you rejecting me before my brother? Right? We talked about that last week. Okay, so what's fair? What does God expect of us, and what do we expect of God? So here are sections of Tanakh we will go through. Yiras Hashem is stressed 7 times in this book. So I know stuff is terrible, but you should have Yiras Hashem. We will translate Yiras Hashem according to different commentaries differently. Okay, on the face of it, it just means fear of God. It's Yirei Shamayim. I will try to show that Yiras Hashem is the element of intellect as opposed to an emotional connection to God. Yiras Hashem asks you to make an intellectual connection to God, as opposed to Avas Hashem, which asks you to make an emotional connection to God. Shir HaShirim is more about emotions. Why do I say Shir HaShirim is a sadder book than this? Because Shir HaShirim is this awful story about two people who are in love who never get to actually consummate their love. The story ends and they're not together. What could be sadder than that? Right? So, Shir HaShirim wants us to make an emotional connection to God. Can you prove to me, from what you might know about the Rambam, prove to me that he would want us to make an intellectual connection to God before an emotional connection? Maybe if you want to date somebody, I don't know, in my time, I met my wife, fell in love with her, I asked her out, and we dated. Today, people are set up on dates, all my kids were set up. Not one of them actually met them and said, hey, you know, let's go for a walk. And, right? They're all in love too, Baruch Hashem, but different. Anyway, I think that there's no right way for any of this. There's no right way to parent, there's no right way to fall in love, because everyone is an individual. Right? Yaakov made his own arrangement. Yitzhak did not. Both those stories are veracious to teach you this. There's no one way to go about this, right? Prove to me that the Rambam would want you to make an intellectual connection before an emotional connection, because
Rambam was a rationalist.
Correct, but prove to me from that should make you, maybe it's important to make an emotional connection first, then intellectual, and then back to emotional, yes?
In the beginning of Mishneh Torah, first he talks about
knowledge
of God, and I think in the third...
Well, his first book is called Manda. His second book is called Ahava.
Okay.
Yeah. It's 14 books. Right? You should have put Abba first.
No, no. Love needs to be informed. You tell me love is blind? No such thing. I'll tell you what's blind. Infatuation is blind. Infatuation will make you blind to some things that maybe you should know more. I'm not saying that that means cut it off. But you have to know the difference between infatuation and true love. True love cannot come to you until you know everything about that, or as much as possible about that person. People change. Things change over time. Yeah, Konami, it's good to fall head over heels, but be more informed before you commit to something you may regret later. All right, so that's Yiras Hashem, okay, intellectual. Echol b'simcha lachmecha, also seven times. Do you have a challah board at home, and at the bottom there's a knife that pulls out, and it says on the knife, Echol b'simcha lachmecha. And you say, what book does that come from? Koheles. Yeah? Because there's also seven times in this book where the author tells you, life stinks. Yeah, sometimes it really does. Don't sweat the small stuff. Accentuate your positives. Hold on to the things that you have. And eat your bread and enjoy it. Find things you like to do and do it. Get yourself a piano. Learn how to play the harp. Learn, I don't know, play guitar. Do something that gives you some joy. Learn how to play a harmonica. I don't know. Do things that imagine how wonderful it is to get joy to start a new mesechta, to figure out the tosfos. All these things. Find things that give you comfort and. And he constantly says in this book, and also Mishlei, to be sure, find that person you love where you can say, I know this was a terrible day, but I'm coming home to my wife that I love so much, so look at me. I can get all this. She'll help me get through this. That's called Echol v'simcha lachmecha. There's seven psukim in this book, like this. You're paraphrasing in English. So I know that this is a terrible thing about life, but hold on to the good things that you have. Stress them. Too often, depression makes you forget all the good things you have, and all you do is concentrate on that one bad thing. Well, that was four bad things. I don't mean to belittle the real problems that some people have, or the physical pain that some people have. Right? You know, necessity is often the mother of invention. Right? See what I mean? You know what I mean by that? Okay. Right. Find what's necessary. Find what works. Okay. So here are the topics, Kiko Helis. Does it say Navi Nehene Chacham Amal there on your page?
Which one?
It says topics in Kiko Helis.
Yeah.
See those four words there?
Yeah.
These four words will divide this entire book. It's really the best way to learn Koheles is to divide the book among these four things. Okay? The first is the Amal. He deals with this in paragraph. Amal is what you do at the gym. Right? Amal is to strive. Itamlut is the modern Hebrew word for exercise. Okay? Amal is what you do in the picture, a painting that I have of Koheles scene. It has all four of these in the picture. Maybe Yamo is gonna be is gonna find true meaning in life. Strive, keep working hard at things. Yeah, but be careful, because since 60% of the things is hevel, maybe 70, maybe even 80% is hevel. Be careful, because amal, being just an amal, so what are you going to do? You're going to give it over to your children? Who knows if they're even going to deserve it? Right? I remember, last class, I think I mentioned, the first targum, right? If you haven't first told us, mine has a targum in it, yes it does. The first targum on the first pasuk in Kohelis says, "Kad chaza Shlomo Malka di Yisrael beruach nevuah, yas malchus rechavam berei, de asid liispalga." I'm not going to work this book. Great, amazing. It's really about the Amal. Because I strove so hard to create a kingdom and to do more with what my father gave me. Right? This is the Targum of why Shlomo wrote the book. And he says, and when Shlomo saw his son behaving in a way that led to the split in the kingdom, so he wrote Kohelis. That's the Amal. You hear it? Who knows what's going to happen, and what are we leaving? What are we... Man with 300 wives should leave his kingdom into someone so unprepared for being king? Right? Rechavam's mother must have been Shlomo's first wife. Because Shlomo ruled 40 years and Rechavam was 41 when he became king. So Rechavam, Rechavam's mother was married to Shlomo while David was still king, a year before David gave over his kingdom. And Shlomo was a young kid. That's strange. All right, whatever it is. Rechavam was not prepared to be king. Look, I'm not going to get political about this, but Perek Chet in Shmuel Bet tells you David's cabinet. It says four people helped David run the country. Perek Daled of Malachim Aleph talks about Shlomo's cabinet. About 30 people are helping Shlomo run the country. Shlomo bloated his kingdom. And we know from the story that they went to Shlomo's son and said, "Your father charges too much taxes. Every one of us has to work 2 months a year without being paid in addition to paying all those taxes. It's too much. You have to lighten the load. If you lighten the load, we will serve you. If you don't, we're going to rebel." So Shlomo Rechavam asked advice, it says, from this Canaan. This Canaan said, listen to that. Give in to them. Then you just give in, say you're going to lower taxes, then you can do whatever you want afterwards. But give in to them. Don't respond with guile. Accept what they're saying. Then it says he asked advice of Yiladim. King at age 41 asks advice of Yiladim. They give childish advice, maybe. Or it may be that they were the children who grew up with him. His colleagues. And they said, you've got to call their bluff. They're never going to rebel against you. And if they do, you kill them. Right? And he answered to them, "My father's thigh is thinner than my pinky." He said, "Kotoni, my small finger, is thicker than my father's thigh. You think he charged you high taxes? Wait till you see what I'm living to. Get out of here." They rebelled. They pointed to Rabbi Ben Levot. And 10 tribes were separated from Yehuda. Okay. Rechavam did send an army to try to fight against them, and thank God there would have been a terrible civil war right at the early part of our kingdom. And a prophet named Obed convinced Rechavam, first of all, you're two tribes against 10. You're not going to win. Right? Second of all, this is part of God's this is your destiny. Suck it up. Okay? So that's why he writes Koheles. Because I can strive and put so much into my life. And where's it going after I die? Anybody here know anything that your grandparents' grandparents did? It's good. They wrote a book where they left you some messages. It's so important to name children after family members. Don't just choose a name because I like it. Choose one that you like, but always name someone so that the bris can talk about your great-grandfather. And someone at the bris, who may be younger than you, will remember that. Right? Because otherwise, what 100 years from now, what's going to be of me? I'm going to be food for worms by then. And what's going to be? Who's going to remember me? Right? Make your mark. Right? So I made my mark. I built the temple. I got a kingdom for my father. And look what my son is doing with it. It's obviously the Derech Nevuah. But I'm going to close today's class by telling you the following. The split in the kingdom, according to a Gemara in Yuma, was destined. It was part of the Goral of David. The Gemara is very good at absolving David of all kinds of averos, with Bathsheba, with Uriah. He's not at fault for counting the people at the end of Shmuel Bet. Yoav is. The Gemara is very good at absolving David. Anybody familiar with the Gemara Masechta Shabbos that admits that one sin of David's has no expiation, no forgiveness, and his kingdom was split in the time of his grandson because of that sin? What would be Mida Keneged Mida?
I think it was cutting Shaul's coat.
That's why he was cold at the end of his life. That's it, Mar Mesech
Shabbos. He was sending Bathsheba's husband to the front.
The Gemara absolves him of that. And it says that, okay. The whole rest of Shmuel Bet is absolution for that. But with Tamar and Amnon and Avshalom, I'm talking about what did David do in his kingdom that could explain that his kingdom should be split in half? It's such an amazing morality play in the Gemara. It's Yuma Daf Chaf Beis. Most people don't even learn this. I teach 7th and 8th grade in the day school. And we learn the merit of Avshalom. During that merit, and you have to know the whole background of the Nazi story. Shaul had a grandson named Mephibosheth, who was crippled. David took care of him and gave a staff of 35 people to look after him because he was Yonatan's son, Yonatan that he loved very much. Right? During the battle, the person in charge of him came to David and said, "Did you know that Mephibosheth was hoping that you and Avshalom would kill each other and that the kingdom would go back to him?" David said, "He said that? Take his property. Everything I gave him in Givat Shaul is now yours." What is the Aveira here?
He was in the word or something.
Kabbalah Slashin Hara, which is so obviously false. And then Mephibosheth, at the end of the war, when David's not in a great mood because Avshalom was killed, but when Mephibosheth comes up to David and says, "My king, the person you put in charge of me maligned me. I did not want you to lose this battle. I only remained in Yerushalayim because I'm crippled. I don't even care about the land you took from me. Just that you're alive." And he's so obsequious and he's so contrite. And David said, "Listen, I don't want to hear any more about this. Split the land." Get it? It's so obvious who's telling the truth here and who's lying. You reward this liar and you accept. So murder Uriah, adultery with Bathsheba, causing a famine and a pestilence that killed 70,000 people at Shmuel Bet, the Gemara clears up. Okay, I wrote a book about this. Called Conflict Thoughts and Homes. Called Conflict Resolution in the Early Prophets. But accepting Lashon Hara, I will not find any absolution for that. Say, split the land, split your kingdom. Imagine that. It's
A heavenly voice comes out and says, you can, with such simplicity, talk about splitting someone's land, so split your kingdom. So that now Shlomo behaves with the same impetuosity. When he makes a room of gasping people think he has the right to cut a baby in half. Right? You know that story. Of course Shlomo never meant to cut the baby in half. But they thought he did. No one objected. No one screamed out, you can't do that! To make people think that you have the power to do that, another heavenly voice comes out there and says, split the kingdom. So that it's already like a goral that Rechavam, the grandson, is going to behave similarly with impetuosity. All right? And make the wrong decision about what to do, splitting his kingdom. Right? Everyone see that? That is the Amal. All my Amalus that I put into my kingdom. Poof! All right? Okay, guys. Let's start next class. The next class, let's start just looking up some of these theodicy psukim, okay? Let's look up Avraham and Moshe. Okay, and you know, do Gidon also. Today's Tehillim is 10 through 15, if you say Tehillim about the days of the week, the days of the month. Do Avraham, Moshe, and Gidon. So just about 15 psukim. Avraham, Moshe, and Gidon. Okay. Alright guys, anybody I missed this morning? I think I got everyone. You losing anything?
Baruch.
Baruch.
Lerman. Brian on there.